Good morning, and the conversation continues here on 94 WIP All Sports Radio as we ease on into a wet WIP Sunday. And in case you're wondering what's going on, the clock only says 6 o'clock. Well, you're wrong. The clock should say 7 o'clock because we leapt ahead into daylight saving time this morning. So time to get up and at 'em with good conversation here on WIP Sunday. And when we come back in just a bit, author Stephanie Harris, her first book, The Poet, now has a sequel. And we'll find out about the sequel, The Poet, and what's up now here on 94 WIP. The WIP time, 7:01. And we're back. It's WIP Sunday here on 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, Stephanie Harris. Stephanie Jo Harris, her initial book, The Poet, and now she's got a sequel. Good morning, Stephanie.
Good morning.
All right. Before we get into the sequel, tell me about The Poet. Let's remind folks what that's about.
The Poet is about, I like to think of it as a morality tale that's hiding underneath a thriller. It's about a woman who goes on vacation and ends up being held captive in an isolated resort and basically kind of follows her thought process and her survival instincts during that situation. She also meets some interesting characters.
Sounds a little scary.
It's definitely not PG. I would agree.
We like scary things, though, don't we?
We need scary things in the world. I agree.
Why?
I think when we're allowed to kind of explore uncomfortable situations in a fictional safe environment, it's a healthy way for people to maybe stay safe, but still get to experience some of the same emotions and thrills that, scary movies or thriller books, things like that allow us to do.
Okay. Tell me about the sequel.
The sequel involves essentially when our main character, Rebecca, who's the lady that's held captive in the first book, one of the individuals that she meets ends up being an assassin, and the second book follows the tale of the assassin and his subsequent involvement with this woman.
And it's called?
The Poet Recusant.
Recusant. I don't think I've ever heard that word before this interview.
Recusant is Latin origin, and it essentially means someone who refuses to follow authority. It started when individuals in England would refuse to follow the Catholic Church. They were called recusants. So.
Okay, interesting notion. Where'd the idea for this series come from, and will there be a third?
There will be a third. I'm currently writing that now. And I think the idea came, I've always had this story kind of floating around in my head, and I felt like I just had to put it out on paper. I don't know that it has a specific origin, just my imagination.
All right. How much of Rebecca is you?
Well, I do have a background working in behavioral health services. I used to run a pretty large psychiatric inpatient unit for a number of years, and Rebecca and I share the same job, so I'm certainly there. There's some overlap there in terms of us having the same job, but beyond that, I think she's a lot nicer and a lot stronger than I am.
You had to be strong, though, to think this story through and get into Rebecca's head.
I try to do that. I try to allow the reader the opportunity to see that and her psychiatric perspective of the world.
Yeah, but does the psychiatric perspective of the world help you as a writer?
I found that it's helpful for me, yes. I try not to get too much into labels or diagnoses or anything like that, but there is a certain amount of kind of basic gut reaction that people feel, and assessing a situation in a rapid time frame, and someone that's used to crisis situations and how they would interact with, you know, suddenly being in an unexpected crisis situation.
You still in the psychiatric business, or have you given up your day job?
Not yet. I still work in a facility outside of Chicago. My role is expanded outside of psych, but I still work with psychiatric as well as inpatient, yes.
That has to be a very hard job, though. I mean, when minds are a little bit different than I would hope yours and mine are, although I'm not too sure about me.
It can be very challenging, very rewarding. Certainly, I think it's not, you know, just like any other job, it's not necessarily for everyone, but I've enjoyed it immensely.
Did it help you, though, to write the story?
I think it did. I think it, you know, in creating some characters and looking at their flaws and some of their actions, having that background in behavioral health, I found helpful. You know, you access different memories and different individuals that you've encountered over your life and maybe take little pieces here and there.
What's Rebecca doing in the woods anyway? By herself. It sounds boring.
Well, she gets stood up. So she actually has a plan to go on a vacation with her boyfriend, but she gets stood up and decides to go anyway because she's a liberated woman, so she ends up in a cabin in the woods and is isolated with very few other people at this place, and unknown individuals come and end up taking the hotel hostage, and the reasons for that aren't clear at the time. But they're certainly violent, and how Rebecca navigates that is a big part of the book.
So Rebecca is not alone. The cabin in the woods is part of a larger resort?
It's part of a larger resort with very few individuals there at the time. So,
do we meet the other characters, or is it pretty much Rebecca and the hostage taker?
Rebecca's our main character, but there's a handful of others that we meet, and as well as several individuals that are there for pretty bad reasons.
Do we get any sense of the bad reasons in the book?
Yes. Yeah. And I'm trying not to, you know, spoil any of the story, but
that's important.
The reasons are explained as you read, and hopefully in a way that's interesting. Instead of kind of laying out all the reasons, you have to read the story and slowly, eventually figure out why they're there and what they want.
Why this book, though? I mean, I would imagine with your background, you might have written something more like I Never Promised You a Rose Garden than this one.
You know, I think I've always been a fan of thrillers and certainly horror movies, and I was a little, personally, I like stories that are frightening and make people uncomfortable, make people think about things that they wouldn't normally think about. So, for me, I enjoy something, a story that really kind of grabs you and a page turner that you can't put down. That's what I personally find interesting, as opposed to, you know, something that's maybe a little more self-reflective or intellectual, or that's just my own personal preference.
Now, covers interest me. Did you have any say in the cover of the book?
I did. Yes, actually, I had the covers for both books designed personally, and they both feature a set of white rosary beads.
Why rosary beads?
One of the characters that we meet has a background of being raised in an orphanage it's a Catholic orphanage, and the rosary beads end up kind of becoming a little bit of a calling card for one of the individuals.
Calling card for one of the good ones or the bad ones, or you're not going to tell?
Well, I think it's up to the reader to decide. His behavior certainly is would look pretty bad, and there's also some things that he does that seem like they might be good. But I never really tell you what he's thinking, so left that interpretation open to the reader.
Good and bad residing in the same individual. Sounds like most of us.
It's just like most of us.
When you wrote the book, were you thinking beyond the printed page into maybe the small screen or the large screen?
Oh, somewhat, I think. I don't know. You know, you start writing a book and you do it initially as a hobby, you're writing, and then you enjoy it. And now I'm on book three. So I think it's always nice to have the idea of I'd like to see what this looks like on screen. But I wouldn't want to jump there necessarily. There are things that you get out of a book that movies just don't have the time for, you know. But I think there's certainly some life-changing movies out there that people enjoy and that I like. And so, yeah, you never want to limit yourself. I wouldn't turn it down, you know.
Well, interesting question then. Which do you value more, a good review or a fat royalty check?
That is a good question. You always want a good review, right? Because that makes you feel good about yourself and validated. And people so far seem to really like it or really hate it. And I certainly know that it's not for everyone. There's some, you know, pretty violent scenes that I think turn people off in a few ways. But but you can't write for an audience. I think once you start writing for an audience, it limits you as a writer, and you start censoring yourself and thinking, how's this going to play, or how are people going to interpret this? So I really try to not pay attention to that. I've actually known some authors that never read their own reviews. I don't know how they have the self-control to do that, but I would recommend it. Because it does start making you kind of question your own writing, and you have to put that aside in order to not censor yourself, you know. So I don't want to write for an audience. I don't want a fluffy Hollywood Hallmark tale. I don't want that. So you kind of have to just say, well, it's not for everybody. Some people are going to hate it. I'd rather they hate it than not finish it. So
now you mentioned violence. What's a nice lady like you know about violence?
Say that again. I'm sorry.
You mentioned violence. What's a nice lady like you know about violence?
I've certainly over the years had my encounters with some hostile situations. I know that healthcare in general can be a very violent environment. So. Sadly, and I know it's something that we're working on. It's a lot of emotions in the hospital, so I've been involved in a few, countless, I would say, interactions that can be frightening and scary, and so a little bit. I know a little bit.
Stephanie Harris, stay with me. I've got to run a few commercials to pay the bills around here. We'll be back in just a bit. You're listening to WIP Sunday. My guest, Stephanie Jo Harris, author of The Poet and The Poet Recusant. We'll be back in just a bit. And we're back. It's WIP Sunday. My name's Peter Solomon, and it's 7:21. You know your clock's not wrong. We jumped into daylight saving time here and across the country. And my guest this morning, Stephanie Jo Harris, her new book, it's a sequel to The Poet, The Poet Rikusand. And Stephanie, who do you like to read?
Let's see. Lately, I would say I've been reading a little bit more nonfiction. I just finished the biography of Jim Jones, Raven, which I found to be interesting. Fiction, I like a lot of the classics. I like Edgar Allan Poe. Certainly, I like Victor Hugo. I like Stephen King, I have to mention.
Oh, absolutely. The reason I ask is I detect the shadow of Stephen King in the poet Rikusant.
Really?
Yeah. There's a Stephen King kind of feel to it. Something sinister.
It has definitely a sinister quality about it. But yeah, I like Stephen King. I haven't read everything that he's done, but I've enjoyed a lot of his work. Yeah.
And you put it in Maine, which is his home stomping ground.
It's in Illinois.
Okay. What's next? Book three?
Book three. Book three is in the works. Port Rikusen is coming out on March 12th. So I'm excited about that and well into writing number three. So,
what happens when the poet's done? Or will it ever be done?
I think I currently have a total of five in the entire series. And then I have a couple other ideas for novels, but I've not started any of those with any real meat yet. They just have basic outlines and scribbles on paper. But I love writing, and I certainly can't imagine not doing it. So I just have to make sure that I get the poet story finished first. I'm a little obsessive about getting that done. It's kind of stuck in my head. So
can't make room for anything new till you put the old stuff out on the curb, as it were.
That's for me, yeah. Right.
You make Rebecca a strong woman. Is that important?
Somewhat. I did my best to make Rebecca a genuine, what I consider to be a genuine woman. So she's certainly afraid, and she has moments of strength and moments of weakness. Some people actually I've had some criticism about the book being sexist, which I found interesting. And I hope that generates some conversation. But there are strong female characters, and I tried to prepare, you know, give her strength and courage, I guess you would say, in dealing with some of these situations. And I think people are complicated, you know, and no one is black and white, and no one is necessarily always strong or always weak. So I tried to give them different layers.
I would agree with that. Will we eventually somewhere in the series find out what these guys were doing on the island?
Yes. Yeah. The reason for their being there is revealed in the first book. The second book kind of explores the poet character a little bit further and his relationship with Rebecca.
And I'd like to go ahead. I'd like to say thank you to Stephanie Jo Harris. Her new books, first she wrote The Poet, and now she's written The Poet Rikusant, coming out March 12th. So it's not there yet, but maybe your bookstore put it out a little early. You never know. Thank you, Stephanie.
No, thank you, Peter.
It's been my pleasure.
Yeah. Have a good day.
You too. And it's been a WIP Sunday here on 94 WIP All Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. We'll be back in just a bit. And we're back. My name's Peter Solomon. It's WIP Sunday. A wet WIP Sunday, it certainly is. But the rain should stop by early afternoon, and things should turn out reasonably well. And I'm pleased to welcome here now for conversation, Sarah Silvers, one of the authors of the new book, I think you're wrong, but I'm listening. It's a book about politics. It's a book about discussing. It's a book about a lot of things. Good morning, Sarah Silvers. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm actually Sarah Holland, and Beth Silvers, my co-author, is here with me as well.
Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning to both of you. I didn't realize that. All right.
That's okay.
Sarah Silvers and Beth Holland. Welcome.
Other way around. Sarah Holland and Beth
Silvers. Okay. It's a little early for all of us.
All yeah, right. It's daylight saving time. All is
what's happened to America that we need a book like this? Because I don't think it's ever been as vicious politically as it has been now. What do you think?
I think that it's really difficult. I try to help myself by keeping a long view of history. I do think we've been in similar situations before, but not in a long time. Part of it is we raise the stakes so high on ourselves. We tell ourselves that every political issue is the end-all, be-all political issue. And so if everything is the end of the world, then it doesn't matter how we treat the other side. The other side is our enemy instead of our fellow citizen.
But what happened to negotiating across the aisle, hands across the aisle, hands across America, if you will, to make it work, to make government work?
I think some of it is information overload. We are all so engaged with information now that it's hard to sort through and create any priorities. And so our politics in some ways have become endless marketing campaigns instead of opportunities for problem solving and collaboration. We try really hard on Pantsuit Politics and in our book not to blame politicians for these problems, because they are creatures of our society, and we all are so busy and taking in so much that the easiest things for us to do processing-wise are hone in on a couple of issues and allow those to be wedge issues that decide elections. And we don't really reward politicians for any kind of across-the-aisle collaboration. We reward them for battling it out in that high-stakes way that Sarah was talking about.
But we look longingly and think longingly for the good old days of Ted Kennedy and John McCain, when negotiating a solution was possible.
We do, but like Beth said, we vote for people, our own Congress people, that stake out their sides on each, either the far right or the far left. It's like we all say we're unhappy with Congress, but everybody keeps electing the same Congress person. We all vote for the incumbent. I think that we look longingly, but our day-to-day political decisions, especially the way we talk to each other and particularly the way we fight on Facebook, reflect different priorities.
But it's not just Congress. It's the resident of the White House as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's right, and I think that a thing that we have to grapple with in America right now is whether the President of the United States is a symptom or disease, and I think lots of us like to classify him as the disease, and I think in truth it's a little bit of both. I don't think we would have gotten to a president who talks this way about other people had we not already been trending in that direction as a populace. And I also think that having someone in the Oval Office who talks this way about political opponents matters and has significantly shifted us even further from where Sarah and I think is a healthy place for us to be as a country.
And I can tell you, I ran for local office in my hometown of Paducah, Kentucky in 2016, and the campaign was completely different than when I ran for re-election in 2018. The tenor of the way people had spoken to each other, the way they were comfortable. I mean, I run in a nonpartisan race, and the first time everybody of the other people in the race were nice to each other. The media covered us very nonpartisanly. There was no vitriol. And in 2 years with the president in the White House, which I attribute to a huge amount of the change, there was such nastiness. And I ran with a woman who'd been running in the same race for I think 3 or 4 terms, and she says, I've never seen it like this. I mean, I think that it does, it's a trickle-down. It's a trickle-down mood. When he sets the tone at the top, then everything becomes acceptable, all the way down to local races.
Guys, I've got to run a few commercials to pay the bills around here, so you stay with me, because we'll be back in We'll be back in just a bit as I say hello to my guests one more time, Sarah Holland and Beth Silvers, here on 94 WIP, their new book, that new book being about civil conversation in politics and a whole lot more. The WIP time, 7:36. And we're back. It's WIP Sunday into the home stretch with Sarah Stewart and Beth Silvers, co-authors of the new book, I Think You're Wrong, But I'm Listening. My name's Peter Solomon. All right, ladies, what led you to write the book?
We've been having conversations on our podcast, Fancy Politics, for several years, and we've been practicing what we call grace-filled political conversations, where we're talking across the aisle, but we're prioritizing our relationship with each other over scoring political points. We wanted to model out conversations that we wish we could hear elsewhere and just weren't hearing. And we decided to write the book because we wanted to reflect on what is that process, instead of just being in those conversations discussing climate change and reproductive rights and trade and all the issues of the day, how are we doing this? And so we wrote the book to describe for other people 10 things that we've learned that are kind of our guiding lights in being able to discuss issues in ways that really enhance our relationships instead of disconnecting us from each other.
And we also spend the first half of the book really encouraging people to look at themselves first. This is not a guidebook or a, you know, super secret sauce to transform the nearest stranger on the street into your political ally. What we really encourage people to do is spend a lot of time thinking about their own values, looking at policies with fresh eyes instead of just adopting the party line, and really thinking through themselves and how they approach the conversation before they start engaging with other people, which is what we spend the second half of the book on.
Is it possible, though, given the current climate, to approach each other, especially people you don't know and may never see again, with respect and civility?
Well, I mean, that's absolutely possible. We do it with each other every week. I mean, Beth and I had not seen each other in 13 years when we started this podcast. We went to college together, but we were not close friends. But we've built a close relationship having conversations about politics for over the years. But like I said, we are definitely not encouraging people to go up to strangers on the street and start engaging about politics. But there are people in our lives who having conversations about politics is really, in a civil manner, is really essential because they're not people we can just exclude. It's heartbreaking to hear how many family relationships have broken down over politics. It doesn't have to be that way. There is a way to prioritize our relationships with people in our lives, especially family members, and to be able to talk about these things in a way that doesn't leave everybody broken and disconnected.
And one of the things that we really encourage in the book is that we do have those conversations, because if we can't do it within our families, how can we expect our members of Congress to get along with one another? You know, if we can't in our community groups and in the people that we're interacting with face-to-face every day adopt a different tone, of course it's going to escalate the further away those relationships become from one another.
And listen, it's probably not possible the very first time. It's a long game. This isn't we're going to do it one time and perfect it. It's that we're going to keep practicing on ourselves, and we're going to keep practicing on each other and bumping up against each other and hopefully rubbing some rough edges off in the process.
Now, my dear sweet granny used to say, especially at the round the family dinner table, don't discuss politics, religion, or money.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes all three of them get mixed up together, especially in America today. So what do you think about
that? That's literally how we start the book, is talking about our grandmothers teaching us that exact same lesson.
So I think that lesson has been damaging, like well-intended, but like most things, if you want to do a good job having hard conversations, you have to have hard conversations. We have to practice that skill. And none of us really stopped talking politics. As we say in the book, we just stopped talking to people who disagree with us. And when we do talk with people who disagree with us, we're not talking to each other and listening and taking information back. We're just debating. We're having competing monologues. And so we love our grandmothers dearly, as I'm sure you do yours, but we want to challenge that piece of advice and say, no, let's Let's dig into these conversations so that we get better at them.
But do we place too much importance on trying to change the other's mind?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. What we always say is try to come to the conversation with curiosity. What we're trying to do is understand each other better, not come in and shame the other person into agreeing with you. Look, I tried that for a long time. I wanted it to be true that I would come to the conversation with the right statistic or the right article, and everyone would see it my way and agree with me. But look, we all know that conversation about politics, they're about emotions. They're about life experiences. They're not about, let's just plug in the right statistics and everyone will agree with each other about the situation. And if we can approach the conversation with, I just want to understand a little bit better, and that, more importantly, there is room at the table for all these different life experiences and perspectives. One of the biggest things we've realized about each other is that we feel differently about government and private industry. It's like we're in a car, and when it comes to the government, I'm ready to press the gas. If the federal government can try to solve the problem, let's try it. And Beth is the brakes, and she's saying, I don't know. That doesn't always work out well. Let's pump the brakes on the federal government as a solution. And when it comes to private industry, Beth's the gas. She's ready to press the gas all the way, and I'm the one saying, I don't know. Let's pump the brakes. Private industry doesn't always make the right call. But the reality is we both need to be in the car. There's room for both of us. The car's not going to go anywhere if we are both simultaneously pressing the gas and the brakes at the same time. We have to do this balancing act and realize that we need both people in the car.
Now, that's interesting to me, though, because my next question would be, who planted the seeds of your individual perspectives that you brought to the table anyway?
I think that is a little bit different for each of us. Mine originated, and this is Beth, early in my life. I grew up on a family farm in a rural area, and I saw firsthand the impact of regulation on our family farm, well-intended regulation. I never questioned why it was happening, but I also saw what happens when you try to solve a problem very far away from the problem itself. And it struck in me this chord that we need to use the tools that we have as close to the problem as possible to solve it. And so that's why I have always favored local decision making and people with expertise in an industry helping make decisions about that industry. Now, I don't think that means that we have no government, right, or we pay no taxes. And I think a problem in our society right now is we think everything has to be at a 100 or a zero. I think there's a reasonable role here for the federal government. I just don't like it to be the problem solver of first resort. And I know Sarah's political influences changed over time. Do you want to talk about that, Sarah?
Yes. I mean, I grew up, actually, when I think about it, so many of the strong political voices in my life at different points were really railing against the Reagan era. First, I had a grandfather who was, as we call him, a blue dog Democrat, and grew up telling me stories about FDR and JFK and felt like, we didn't have a family farm. He had farmed on and off, but he really felt like the working man was the center of the Democratic Party and that these figures in his political history had really stood up for them. And I took some time as I grew older, and I grew up in a very evangelical community, and I became more social. I had more socially conservative views until I went to college. And then I was taught as a political science major, by a lot of professors who were reacting strongly to the changes of the Reagan era still in the late 90s, and learned a very progressive politics, a very progressive outlook on politics. And so I think that those two voices at different points in my life really align to help me see that in the past the federal government had been a strong regulator, had been very protective of the working class, and that had benefited a lot of people, and that had been really, really scaled back in the 80s. I was born in 1981. And so I think that narrative is really what built my outlook as the federal government is not always the solution, but we have a strong history of people really thriving when we had a strong federal government, and we've been missing that for several decades.
All right, then, given your personal perspectives, how do you have a civil conversation on things like climate change, things like women's health issues?
Well, that's a really good, well-timed question. We just had a very intense conversation about the Green New Deal. And I think one of the things that really happens in our conversations is that we give each other the benefit of the doubt. Because we're both Americans, because we are both friends and we prioritize that relationship, I know that Beth is concerned about climate change. I'm not having a conversation where I feel like the stakes are the planet and this person doesn't care. I know she cares. I know she realizes that this is a incredibly important problem and that it is something we need to pay attention to right now. So we're not arguing emotionally about the stakes. We're arguing about how to get to a solution that is acceptable to everyone. And so we feel differently about the Green New Deal, and we feel differently about regulations. But it's never of that we're arguing about whether or not climate change is an issue at all.
And I think that's something that goes to that personal work that we have to do. I often find, as a Republican voter, that the Republican Party, because we don't think the federal government is the solution to a problem, we just try to talk the problem out of existence. And I don't think that's healthy. And so the work that I do on myself in these conversations is to come to the table and say, yes, of course, we need to care about our planet. We need to worry about women's rights in the process of discussing reproductive health. You know, I have to acknowledge the problem. I care about health care and can see that our current system is not working. Okay, now let's talk about what solutions I might bring to the table versus the solutions Sarah might bring to the table. And my grace for her is knowing that she doesn't want to turn our country into a communist state where the government has control of everything. She sees the risks when you bring the federal government as a tool to a problem. And so where is there space for us? If we can't agree on draft legislation, which is fine, that's not what we have to do in our conversations with each other. Where are the spaces where we have some common ground or some common interests or just real differences, but I can walk away from the conversation understanding why those differences exist better because I learned something from listening to her.
How do you have civil conversations, though, when matters of faith enter into it, as it often does in things like women's health?
Well, you know, I think so often what we're talking about when we're talking about particularly difficult social issues are matters of values. And so, you know, Beth and I are both pro-choice, but we had a woman on our show once who was intensely pro-Catholic and pro-life. And we did have a civil conversation because, again, we were trying to give each other the grace that, in the benefit of the doubt, that you deserve to be at this table, even if I vehemently disagree with the way you want to, the solution you're presenting. And also, you know, what I try to tell myself, particularly post-2016, is, you know, I don't think there are any immediate plans for Louisiana to leave the union, and I don't think California is going anywhere either. So even if it's difficult to think about, and even if we're all angry and emotional, like pragmatically, I don't think anybody wants to break up the union yet. And so let's acknowledge that we all are Americans. We're not going anywhere. And so we do have big problems to solve. We have work we need to get together on, even if we can't, we're not always going to agree on every single thing. You know, it's so interesting when Beth and I talk about some of these difficult issues, how we do find solutions that make us both feel like we're moving forward, even if they're not our A-plus solution we both want. When we talk about health care, you know, I'm okay with Medicare for All. I'm ready for that solution, and Beth isn't. What we found in between the two positions is that we would both like to move away from employer-based health care. We don't think that's working for anybody. And so that was a good solution that meets both of us. When we talk about welfare, we talk about the social safety net, we're both there aren't solutions on either end that make us both happy, but we're both ready to examine a universal basic income. So there are these solutions that never get talked about that have something for both sides because both sides are too busy staked out on the extremes and refusing to listen to each other.
And I love that you ask us about civility when faith comes into play because for us, we want something a little bit different than civility. We feel like civility can be very surface level. And so that's why we advocate for grace-filled political conversation. And that does originate in our faith. You know, we both believe that it is as important to bring our values that originate from faith, like respect for other human beings, like kindness, like upholding another person's dignity, to the process of the discussion, not just to the policy that we're arguing about. I think too often we say, well, my faith means that I land on this side of an issue. Well, sure, but my faith also means that I treat the person in front of me as I want to be treated. My faith also means that I love this person with all my heart. And I think we kind of put politics in a box and act like anything goes in that discussion. And in that way, we're leaving our faith out of the conversation in a really unhealthy way.
Ever thought of sending a copy of the book to the White House?
Well, it's funny that you ask. Yes, we have a listener initiative right now to send the book to all of the members of Congress. Our listeners organized a spreadsheet and are hand-delivering books to their representatives' offices with letters about why they want them to read the book. We've got about 40% of the Senate covered right now, and we would love to see this filter its way up to the White House because we really want this to be a book that helps and kind of a balm for this time, and it will take everyone's participation at some level. Now, that said, you know, people who tell us this is all very unrealistic, I think that's okay. If you think about how many Americans sit out the political process right now, you know, don't vote, don't attend city council meetings, don't really, can't name their members of Congress, if just some of those people would come back into the process and insist that the process be a little bit better, that will have ripple effects that really change the tenor of conversation.
And I'd like to say thank you to my guests this morning, Sarah Stewart and Beth Silvers, for bringing civility to our discussion. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
It's been my pleasure. And it's been another edition of WIP Sunday. Be careful if you're out there. It's wet, a little bit slick. Also, watch out for the parade if you're coming into Center City. Nothing left to say, but thank you to Phil Jackson, this morning's producer, and Ann Tidman-Solomon, my wife and associate producer. Couldn't do the show without either one of you. Stay dry. See you soon.